and Consumer Affairs Committee, and we will open a public hearing, a joint public hearing on House Bill 2814 and 2815. Representative Berger.
Good morning.
Good morning, Representative.
Hello, happy Friday morning, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Vicki Berger from House District 20, which is here in the Salem area. I'm here to just sort of introduce two bills, House Bill 2814 and House Bill 2815. I've sponsored these two bills in recognition of the fact that the wine industry has become an important part of the agricultural landscape of the Willamette Valley and indeed the whole state of Oregon. Oregon wine is gaining a well-deserved worldwide recognition. Part of the reason for that recognition is the work of Jim Bernot, who you'll hear from, I'm sure, today, for growing, producing, and promoting wine in the at Willamette Valley Vineyards. His has been, I'm here to tell you, a very unique business strategy, which encompasses a voluntary commitment from his shareholders to be part of the winery workforce. This is a very unique thing that he does. If you've not visited it, it's a wonderful facility, and I would encourage you to. Through the efforts of Jim at Willamette Valley Vineyards and the other pioneers of Oregon wine, we have derived significant economic development from the relatively new industry, and the growth potential for wine in Oregon is enormous. It is my hope that through these simple bills, we can further promote what is uniquely Oregon. Not only the ingredients inside the wine, but also the way we recycle the wine bottles. I thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me a chance to just briefly introduce these bills and for the attention of the committee on these matters.
Thank you, Representative. Any question? Do not see any. Thank you for coming in this morning. Could I have Jim Bernot and Jess Lyon? And we must have Greg Thomas, too. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Bernot. I'm the founder and president of Willamette Valley Vineyards.
Let's start out, Jim, with 2814, if you could, please.
And the bill relates to... recycling. I have testimony that's now just being distributed to you that speaks to this issue. Ever since we began our wine sales at Willamette Valley Vineyards, we have encouraged our customers, including our shareholders, to recycle. And so we have offered a 10-cent refund for bottles that are returned, wine bottles that are returned to the winery, which are then used, of course, to apply against their next purchase when they're there. And what this has done, of course, is provided an opportunity for people to actually get these bottles, these wine bottles, recycled by bringing them back directly to the manufacturer. Now, we've been doing this by word of mouth. We actually, in another business I owned, encouraged beer bottles to be brought back to the brew pub in the same manner. And in my testimony, you'll see on the second page an enforcement letter from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which says that the Willamette Valley Brewing Company will post a sign at the brewery informing customers that a 10-cent per bottle refund is no longer in effect. You'll immediately begin artwork to correct the refund information on the wine, on the bottle labels and packaging for the product, and so on. And what they did was they believed that our encouragement of the 10-cent refund was an illegal coupon because it was printed on the label. And so we, of course, complied with the OLCC in their request. We asked them that we not throw away the $176,000 worth of labels and packaging we'd printed, and we worked out an agreement where I think we only lost about $6,000 on their enforcement action. And then what you'll find in my attachment on my testimony is the amendment we actually made to Senate Bill 300 in the 1997 session, which actually gave us the authority through the legislature to provide a 10-cent refund on these beer bottles. Unfortunately, because of the way the language was drafted and the nature of the bill, we only dealt with breweries, not with wineries. And so we were not, unfortunately, able to take advantage of this under, the winers not be able to take advantage of the changes in the law. But the law says that, the bill was that says that we could provide an excess of 5 cents per container for the purposes of encouraging purchasers to return the containers directly to the brewery or brewery public house. And so we finally got it into the law. Unfortunately, we feel that we are uncertain as to whether we can do this. We have requested ever since this policy was adopted by the legislature of the OLCC to allow us to use this return policy on wine bottles. And each time we've asked, we've been told no. And so that's the reason why the bill is before you. We believe it's a good public policy to encourage manufacturers who want to voluntarily encourage their customers to recycle and to bring the product back to the point of origin to be a good public policy. And that's the reason for the bill.
Any questions?
Yes. Yeah.
Representative Shaw.
What's this mean anyway?
Oh, that's a handout on the second piece of bill legislation.
I said question for you. Now, and no, the grocery stores and distributors, they're not responsible for any of this.
No.
Sense.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a great idea. I do have a question about, I have several wineries in my district, King Estate being one of them. I'm wondering if I can take my Willamette Valley Vineyard bottles to the King Estate Winery. Well, is that going to work that way? Can you take it to any winery, or does it have to go back to the specific winery?
Well, this will be a voluntary refund that we're asking that the lawmakers allow us to offer, which means that each winery would be able to determine whether or not they wanted to offer this refund policy on their bottles. So it would be, if we had this authority, we would ask that we put this on our labels, encourage consumers to bring our bottles back to our winery. What we do then is we take those bottles, we return those bottles over to Saga, which is a company that actually does the recycling of the bottles. So it would not affect King Estate unless they wanted to do their own program.
Oh, I see. Follow me, Mr. Chair? So if King Estate, for example, decided they'd participate in this program, I guess my question is, can I take my Willamette Valley Vineyard bottles, if you also participate, back to the King Estate Winery?
I think that'd probably be up to the policies of King Estate Winery as to how they wanted to honor that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clear up whether the issue is giving the refund or being able to advertise the refund.
It's being able to put it on the label.
Okay.
We actually, by word of mouth, have been doing this ever since we've been in business. And our customers and our shareholders love the idea of getting the glass back to the point of origin where it can be most efficiently processed and dealt with. This is a progressive idea to reduce the amount of containers that are having to be dealt with in other manners, including through our landfill or through our other recycling processes. The problem is that the OLCC in the past has viewed this as a illegal coupon to list a 10-cent refund on a label or on a package. That's where the problem lies.
And so the wording that you're proposing in the Dash 1 amendments, credit toward future purchases at the winery, that's okay to put that on?
Well, the amendment asked to change the word from credit to refund, and that's in the original drafting.
That's okay?
Yes. In the original drafting of the bill, we made an error by using the word credit, and I think that definitely attracted a lot of attention. You might have heard from perhaps others about the issue of the use of the word credit. That was a drafting error. And you'll notice if you look at the language that was passed by the previous legislature in 1997 that dealt with beer bottles, it related to a refund.
Okay, any other questions? I don't see any. Do you gentlemen have some testimony on the bill on 2814? Let's move on to 2815.
Well, what I'd like to do is I would like to, the reason why this issue is before you is because we've made a most remarkable discovery. And in that discovery, we have included information on our label applications to the federal government, our wine label applications to the federal government, which lists an antioxidant called resveratrol. And the federal government approved two of our label applications and turned down the third application. And when the time that they turned down our third application, we felt that it was in the public interest for us to continue to be able to apply that antioxidant on our label, and therefore felt that even if we could only limit the listing of the antioxidant on our labels for sale only in intrastate commerce, it was still a benefit to do so. And that's why we sought the legislation. And I would like to introduce Greg Thomas, who has been with us since June of last year from Oregon State University, to help us with this project. And I want him to tell you about this remarkable discovery about this antioxidant.
Thank you. Like you said, my name is Greg Thomas. I'm an employee at Willamette Valley Vineyards and a student at Oregon State University. And I've been researching resveratrol for about a year now. What you have in front of you is this graphic that I have here. It shows resveratrol, which is, like Jim said, is an antioxidant. It lowers levels of cholesterol in your body. The first chart on the top is done at Cornell University by a researcher named Roy Creasy. He broke down resveratrol by grape varietal, Cab Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Pinot Noir, and other red wines he tested, which are some of the sweeter blends from California. And it clearly shows that Pinot Noir does have an advantage in the amount of antioxidants in the skin. From this research, research in 1997, we showed over our last six vintages that the Willamette Valley clearly has a distinct advantage in the amount of antioxidants in our wine. And this is believed to be still being researched. It's due to a moist, cool climate that makes the grape produce more resveratrol to defend itself against rot. Thank you.
The reason why we wanted to tell you, though, that we have had a major breakthrough. When we introduced legislation, and thank goodness for Representative Vicki Berger and this legislature, who allowed us to move forward on a state level, because we felt that the federal government was overreaching in its disapproval of the use of the term this antioxidant on our label. The federal government has reconsidered its opinion, and just this last Monday has approved our third label application, which lists antioxidant as a resveratrol on the label. This is a major breakthrough for the entire wine industry in America, but most specifically for those here of us in Oregon, because we happen to reside in a place where this remarkable antioxidant that is so important for our cardiovascular system happens to come from our grapes in great abundance. And so what we're asking you to do today is to withdraw the bill, to remove the bill from your docket, because we no longer believe that it is necessary.
Okay, any questions? Representative Schaffer.
I look forward to the day when they come up with a beer that makes you feel and look younger.
They already have that, Representative Schaffer, all of them.
Beer, you feel it look younger, I suppose.
So we're doing well.
Any other questions?
I got one. Mr. Chair.
Lost track of where I'm at here.
I have a question. Does white wine contain the same ingredient?
It only in modest amounts, and here's the reason why. When you make wine, to make a white wine, you press the juice from the skins, and that becomes pumice, and you put it back out in your vineyard. And then you use only the juice in white wine to ferment. But when you make red wine, you knock the berries from the stems, and you ferment the berries on the skins in the fermenter. And what happens is, in that process of extraction of fermentation, that resveratrol, these powerful antioxidants, are released into the wine. And because wine is absent of oxygen and has alcohol in it, it protects and keeps that antioxidant effective up until the time that you open the bottle and start to drink it. If you leave the bottle open too long, believe it or not, the effectiveness of that resveratrol will dissipate. So you have to consume it fairly soon after you open the bottle.
I knew there was a reason why I did that.
Yeah, I knew there was a reason I asked that question.
Mr. Chair, I'm confident after that you will look and feel younger.
This antioxidant, is that what's advertised on TV, to whiten your teeth?
You know, I don't think red wine will do that, Mr. Chairman.
Darn.
If you might recall, back in 1991, 60 Minutes ran a broadcast called The French Paradox. this broadcast changed the world of wine, and it created a tremendous increase in the consumption of red wine as well as the consumption of wine, period. Well, what we've learned through this research is that all red wines are not equal. That it's Pinot Noir, grown in cool climates like the Willamette Valley, that actually possesses this powerful resveratrol in great abundance. That is our unique distinction and advantage, and that's why we felt that the federal government should go ahead and allow us to list this, because it was a point of distinction. And fortunately, they have agreed to do so, reversing a attitude or behavior on their part ever since they had been authorizing alcohol wine labels.
One last comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think milk's days are numbered as a state beverage.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add, if you look at the statistics on the value of wine relative to other agricultural products, if you include the entire value of $220 million, you'll note that wine has already just recently surpassed Christmas trees in its value and is now ranked only number 6 behind number 5 milk in Oregon, and we're gaining.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2815 and leave the hearing open on House Bill 2814. And could I have Paul Romaine, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I am living proof that drinking lots of beer makes you look younger.
What's in the cup, Paul?
I refuse to answer on the grounds of my temper. I'm glad I don't have to testify on 2815. The feds took care of it, and that was basically going to be my testimony. That federal issue, they've done the right thing. It's a big controversy. Frankly, health claims on labels, and I'm glad that they did approve the label. 2814 is not what it seems, and that's the reason I'm up here. Today, if you wish to have a returnable product, wine bottles, milk cartons, anything, you could voluntarily put a refund on it. There's no restriction in the Oregon law. What there is a restriction is on in Oregon law is on coupons, which is basically something that where you get money back for something that must be used for the purchase of alcohol. And that's where the OLCC steps in and says no. And Mr. Bruneau's questions to the OLCC over the years always involved the idea of a credit towards the purchase or some money off the purchase of the alcohol. If it's simply bringing back a stick of wood, bring back a stick of wood to the winery and we'll give you 10 cents or 20 cents or $5, you can do that. There's no restriction. It's the use of the money requiring it to be used. Now, most people who come to the winery are probably going to use it on the purchase of alcohol or something related at the winery. They're not going to bring back wine bottles. But there's no restriction. And I believe Mr. Bruneau has been told by the Liquor Control Commission that if you want to do a refund, there is no restriction on that. If you want to do a credit, there is, then you can't do that. If you require that it be used on the wine or something on alcohol, then you can't do it. So what I'm saying to you is 2814 is absolutely unnecessary. The way it was originally written, it would have allowed a coupon of 10 cents or more to be used, that had to be used towards the purchase of the alcohol. And that always has been illegal under Oregon law. There have been no coupons for beer or wine that have been allowed to have cents off alcohol. That's just a policy that has been in effect for a long period of time. The reason for it, frankly, goes back to you really don't want these coupons coming out that, you know, in effect, by the time you get the discounts, you have, end up with free jug wine or things like that. So what the OLCC, if you ask them to come up, they will tell you that a refund is perfectly permissible. Now, back in the days when we changed the deposit on beer bottles, that, you have to understand, is in Oregon law. Right now, beer and soft drinks are part of the bottle bill. They're the only things that are part of the bottle bill. the deposit is 5 cents. What the law specifically said was that you could, if you wish to, charge a greater deposit than the 5 cents. That's what it authorized. The difference between the reason wine was never included, never even contemplated at that time, because it's not part of the bottle bill. There is no deposit on wine bottles. But you can, again, voluntarily, as we used to have, remember, with the old Coke and Pepsi, 2 cent returns? Well, at least a couple of people up there are old enough to remember that. Some of you are not. But we had the old voluntary programs where you brought back your stuff, it was 2 cents, and that was because the manufacturer wanted the bottle back. They could put 2 cents on it. There's nothing to restrict that today. The only thing that's mandated to be in the system is beer and soft drinks. You could have anything else you want. You could set up a deposit system. So you don't need either one of these bills. I'm glad that Mr. Bruneau agrees on 2815, and I'm actually very glad that the feds did what I think is the right thing, because there is some health benefit to this product. But you do not need 2814 to do what Mr. Bruneau is describing. You can do it under today's law. Be happy to answer any questions.
And you can put it on the label?
I can put it on the label.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Thank you, Paul, for your testimony. Thank you. Bill Cross, please.
For the record, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I am with Willamette Valley Vineyards today. And I, in response to Mr. Romaine's comments, I did contact OLCC about 10 days ago, indicating that we were getting amendments to the bill to clarify that our request was to allow a label to indicate that there would be a refund available if a consumer brought a wine bottle back to the winery. And I said, is that permissible? Can we put it on the label? Because indeed, we have been told by OLCC that the ability to provide a refund is permissible. It's whether or not you can put it on the label. And she said, the OLC staffer I talked to said, well, probably. And I said, well, probably doesn't make me feel very comfortable that we would get the results we're looking for. I said, can you get me a written statement that would indicate that it would be permissible? And I have not received a written statement. So I'm a little unclear as to whether or not, while they would allow the refund policy, whether or not we could actually put it on a label.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. So, Bill, you're going to put refund in there instead of credit. Is that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, that's correct.
Well, will it be a specific amount? It's in the language. I haven't put all the amendments and language together, but it says a credit of 10 cents or more. Will it be a specific amount, or will it vary from winery to winery?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, it would be not to exceed 10 cents.
And then,
so I guess it could vary from winery to winery if they wanted to do a nickel or a dime, but...
Thank you. And then on this language, as OLCC talked to you about this, changing credit into refund, you have not discussed this amendment language with them yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, yes, I gave them a hand and gross version of what we submitted to Legislative Council, and then that's what I also presented to the staff person who handles, I guess, the rule opinions.
I think Janet pointed out to me on there that says not less than 10 cents.
I stand corrected, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Lyon. I'm a partner in with Davis Wright Tremaine, the Portland law firm, and my practice focuses on winery matters. And we represent Willamette Valley Vineyards, and we've consulted with our client on this issue and this bill. Our concern is that the OLCC rule that currently addresses discount coupons speaks not only to price reductions, which effectively a credit would have been, but also speaks to rebates. And so that's why we think it's important to clarify here in statute that this voluntary program like this not only makes good economic and environmental sense, but in fact is lawful. And we'd like to clarify that in statute to avoid any later application of existing discount coupon rules to prohibit this program. Now, I can give you the OAR site for anybody who's interested. That's OAR 845007-10.
845007-10.
Correct. It creates a definition for discount coupon.
Is there any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. John, would you like to comment? Okay.
Either way.
Well, do they need this bill or not? That I'd like to find out from John whether they...
I would too.
Yeah, John.
I'm sorry, these are great.
Good morning,
Nothing
Mr.
Like
Chair.
Being put on the spot, you know where you want to be. Huh?
I'm with the OLCC, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I'm members John Steubenvall, Communications Director with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Mr. Chair and members, OLCC takes no position on this bill. We are neutral on this legislation, but I might just comment on a couple things. I think, as you've heard, by our read, a winery could offer a refund for its wine bottles at its winery today. We believe that could happen today. Now, whether the consumer would understand that container is not part of Oregon's bottle bill or not, whether the consumer would understand that or not, we take no position on. That might be another matter. The question of labeling, however, in practical effect, the OLCC relies very heavily on the federal government, the federal agency formerly known as BATF, to approve wine labels for the Oregon marketplace. So in practical effect, an alcohol producer will seek approval from the federal government for its label, and the OLCC will rely heavily on that federal paperwork to approve that label for the state of Oregon. So I think one practical concern we might have and might want to find, should this legislation proceed, we would probably want to find out further what's the labeling staff workload impact for the OLCC should this legislation proceed. In other words, is the OLCC going to be having to approve a whole lot of labels that we're not approving today? Now, if the federal government will approve a label with or without some refund statement on it, that's fine with us. Again, we rely heavily on the federal government. But if the OLCC is going to get into the label approvement business, you know, then there would probably be some fiscal impacts that, you know, we would ask the committee to, you know, allow us to take a look at that.
Do you know, does the federal government do they prohibit having refund on the label of a wine bottle?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, certainly the federal government approves bottle bill containers today. I mean, containers that are under Oregon and other states, you know, so-called bottle bills. And those labels roll downhill to us from the federal government. So, what view the federal government would take of the proposal before you today, I'm afraid I wouldn't want to speak for the federal government.
Okay. Any questions of John? Don't see any. Thank you, John. Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 2814? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2814. This is Steve March here. What about 2180? Both, huh? I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2180. And Janet, can you give us a... Run down on the bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2180 is replaced by the Dash 1 amendment. So you should have those at your place. The Dash 1 amendments, if you remember the hearing on this bill, the Building Codes Division issues elevator permits and coordinates all inspections of elevators. Under current law, elevators are required to be inspected annually. And the original bill would have allowed the division to develop standards and appropriate intervals for inspections by administrative rule instead of having that annual requirement specified in the statute. The agency indicated that they were going to work with the stakeholders that deal with elevators and elevator inspections and come up with a bill that was broader than that. So you have the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments eliminate the new types of licenses that were in the original bill, and they separate the elevator permit process and fees from the inspection schedule, so they'll be separate processes. Mr. Chair, the agency is here to explain, and that's all I have.
Oh, where's the sign-up sheet?
There isn't one.
Mr. Long, you want to?
Are we doing 2180 or 2181?
2180.
Is Mark Long outside?
Yeah.
Act like you're sleeping. Oh, hey, thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Just about moving to the next session.
Comments on 2180?
Yeah.
Okay. We're there.
Thank you.
If you need a few more minutes, don't let us know. We'll wait for you. I appreciate that.
Representative. Good morning, Mr. Chair, for the record. Mark Long with Building Codes Division. Where am I at today? House Bill 2180 is one of our bills that's going to make the elevator program run a little bit better. And we worked since the hearing that we had on this with a work group and received support from Building Owners and Manufacturers Building Owner Managers Association and a variety of our other stakeholders, and we believe the bill is ready to go with the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. And the Dash 1 amendments do what?
Mr. Chair, they clarify what our original intent was, and that is to allow the division to prioritize elevator inspections. You may recall when we had a hearing some time ago, current law has us inspect every elevator in the state on an annual basis, regardless of how big it is. If it only moves 10 inches or 10 floors, we treat them the same. This amendment clarifies that we're not going to change any fees, we're not going to change any authority of the boards, we're not going to change any authority of the division. We're simply going to go in and prioritize by rule, working through our boards, the frequency of these inspections, and we had to figure out through the amendments how to tie that in to the existing statute, and we missed that on the first draft. So it's a product of a work group, and we have consensus with the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Shoffler.
Yeah, Mr. Long, so everybody's happy with this, right? Installers, the union, the consumer, the operators, everybody's happy with this, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, yes, everybody's happy, and we're very happy, and it's going to allow us to operate a little bit better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As to Representative Shoffler's question, I got a call from Catherine Van Natta this morning with the Northwest Pulp and Paper Workers. She was not able to come today. She has seen the amendments, and they do support the amendments. So.
Good. So the pulp and paper workers are okay with this bill then?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to make sure for the record.
It wasn't the workers.
It
wasn't the pulp and paper workers.
It is the producers.
It was the
we can hold on.
The producers.
Okay, any questions of Mark? Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee, this bill has a referral to Ways and Means, and that we intend to ask that the referral be removed, and so we're going to hold on to the bill. Right, Janet? All right. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2180, and open the work session on House Bill 2181. And Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill also has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and will probably have the same fate with the request of the Speaker. Mr. Chair, this is a very large bill. You'll be happy to know two things. Most of the meat is on the first five pages, with the bold language on the first five pages. And the other thing you'll be happy to know at your place today is a copy of the statutes, all the statutes that are repealed by the bill. So this bill actually reduces the size of the ORS. Mr. Chair, again, this bill had a hearing, and the issue was all the licenses, permits, and certifications and registrations that building codes adopts to govern persons, the education requirements, training requirements, how they may be sanctioned, and how they may requalify after they've been sanctioned. We're all different across the statutes that manufactured structures, the plumbing board, the electrical and elevator board, and the board of boiler rules. What this statute does is standardize some things across all of the licensing statutes, again, in those first five sections. And the other thing it does is give some flexibility to the boards in other cases, so that both some standardization and some flexibility. And it doesn't change any of the substantive requirements for the the licenses. Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey had the work group on this bill, and he may have some comments as well as anyone from the agency.
Excuse me.
Thank you.
Representative Holvey?
Mr. Chair, it was a work group that started out with a lot of disagreements, and I think we narrowed the scope of the bill to achieve pretty much an agreement on it. I guess my understanding, there's a few technical issues in the bill, a few minor statements that we're comfortable moving ahead with the bill, that those will be fixed on the Senate side. However, if it is held over, we might perhaps have time to do that between now and the time we see it again, if in fact you're going to work for a rescind on to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you for all your hard work on this. It's greatly appreciated. Mark and Jared, did Representative Kitts?
I'll let them speak first in case they answer my question.
All right.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Again, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. Yes, this again is another one of our regulatory streamlining bills. This is probably our largest package that Building Codes is working on, and I think staff accurately and completely communicated what we're attempting to do. We're really trying to just make our services better for licensees that we serve. We license 42,000 people in the state, and the terms, the names, the renewal periods, the procedures are all different between those program areas, and this bill attempts to make it consistent, streamline it, and allow some flexibility. And I do want to thank Representative Holvey for his work and his staff's work in helping coordinate the various meetings between the time of the hearing and today. I'm going to guess that we've probably had 10 to 15 meetings, both individually with the stakeholders that are impacted by this bill, as well as at least two group meetings, if not more than that, I'm going off of memory here. So the Dash 1 amendments we received yesterday morning, I have to commend Legislative Council. This is basically a replacement of the bill, and they've done a great job. There are a couple words we'd like to make changes in the bill, and I do understand the referral to Ways and Means that we'll have to work on. From our standpoint, there is not a fiscal impact, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if I didn't get the representative's questions addressed.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Long, for being here to testify on this bill. It's always a pleasure to start my weekend with your testimony. Section 2 of the bill. I've asked a couple of my colleagues. I've read it several times to myself, tried to dissect it. I'm sorry? Give me just one second here. Mr. Chair, give me one second.
Sure, Representative
Shaw. Representative Shaw.
I'll just sit here and have a moment of silence and get even with Mr. Long.
I could meet with you outside of the chambers if you'd like. You could probably talk out there.
Out in a dark alley. Mr. Chair, Mr. Long, Mark, what are the two words we're going to change in here?
The two words are on page 2 of the amendments, line 21, we're going to add the words building officials. Basically, what it states on line 19 is this section does not authorize the adoption of rules regulating, and it says inspectors, plan reviewers, and municipalities. We need to add building officials to inspectors, plan reviewers, and municipalities. That we agreed upon that. It's just an oversight on our information that we gave to Legislative Council.
And Mr. Chair,
follow.
Those are the only two words that we need to change before we send it to Ways and Means, and it goes over to the Senate. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, that's all I'm aware of. We spent all day combing this bill with five of our staff members to make sure that we were comfortable with it. 20.
That's the last one.
Jenna?
Mr. Chair, one of the things was to try to standardize what things are called, I guess. And I just noticed that in line 16 of the first page, it still says licensing, certification, or registration. Were you not able to get rid of those terms and make them all license?
Mr. Chair, Janet, Representative Janet. wanted to make sure I got that correct. But,
her pay grade's a little higher.
I understand, believe me. we had to use the broad terms for the areas of plumbing, electrical, boiler, and elevator. We were able to use the word licenses, but we still have certification registrations carried without, and we wanted to have the flexibility to touch on those areas if we needed to. But this bill was designed at those primary trade groups to make things consistent, and it does it.
Okay, thanks.
Are you ready, Representative Kitts?
I think so. I'll make a feeble attempt that's conducive to my pay grade at this question. We'll rely on those who are several pay grades above me to answer it. In the old Section 2 of 2181, is the current Section 2, I'm not seeing the germaneness of the two sections. I'm wondering if Section 2 in the original bill has been moved to a section numbered something other than number 2, question 1, and if not, what has been, has Section 2 as is in the original bill simply been taken out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, thank you very much, Janet.
Please don't ask me to repeat it. I don't know that I could.
I think I understand. Well, my first attempt, as lame as it will be, is that this bill is more or less, these amendments are replacements, so we're deleting pages 2 through 65 of the original bill and inserting the new language. So related to Section 2 on the original bill, page 1, if you give me a second, I'll read that. Maybe Jared could do it for me because I am a state worker. Person owner operating plan does not make it.
Section 2 of the original bill is very short. It said a person owning or operating a plumbing business may not maintain a suit or action in a court of this state unless the person alleges and proves that at the time of performing the work, the person had a valid plumbing business license issued by the state plumbing board. That's what the original language says. Now, the language in the amendment is completely different under what is now Section 2. So I'm wondering if, as in the previous work group that I served in, things were numbered, Section 2 became Section 6, et cetera. So I'm just wondering if this has been renumbered anywhere in the bill.
Mr. Chair of Zunkitz, I don't believe so. In fact, I think that language is deleted from the bill. Is that the way staff looked at that as well?
I can't say, but I didn't see it anywhere else.
Yeah, I don't see it anywhere else, Representative Kitts, and I think.
No, I wasn't given the amendment. I don't have it anywhere.
So that wording is not anywhere within the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of it being anywhere. It is a 50-page amendment, but I believe that wording was deleted.
Okay.
I'd be happy to. We're going to have an opportunity because we have to deal with the fiscal issue. I'll be happy to put on my reading glasses and comb through this more thoroughly.
Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I'm not exactly positive. This is quite some time ago, but I do believe we talked about this at the work group in that not always does the person owning or operating actually hold the license, and sometimes there could be somebody working on the job that doesn't have a license that might be an apprentice or I think if I remember correctly that the legislative council was uncomfortable with this because there may be situations where in fact we could be wrong in forbidding somebody to have a suit under this. And I think if I remember correctly, that is why they took it out, is that we're creating a situation where we're forbidding somebody from making a lawsuit, which they may be entitled to do.
That's how I read that section. And I
so I think that's why they took it out.
That thing.
I defer to we'll have to check with legislative council on that if Mark doesn't have or his staff isn't here to answer that.
Well, committee, we're not going to move this bill today. There's some additional tweaking that it needs, and then we want to remove the referral to Ways and Means, so it'll come back to us. We can get that answer. And
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Certainly.
If at the time that we bring the bill back, since we're not going to be moving the bill forward at this time, we could have the amendments that are going to be drafted. Therefore, we could send the bill, either rescind the referral to Ways and Means and send the bill to the Senate, or send the bill to Ways and Means, either one I'm fine with. But if we could have the amendments at the time so that the committee is sending the bill as we want it to be written over wherever we're sending it, would be great, if you don't mind.
Not a problem, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
And this particular issue.
In other words, you want the engrossed version.
Yeah, I mean, if we're gonna hold the bill over at this point, I'm more comfortable sending the bill as this committee sees fit over, as opposed to sending it over saying technical fixes, housekeeping, whatever that may be, we'll fix it on the other side. I mean,
and it's not our intention to do that. Our intention is to fix it. When it goes, it should be, as far as we're concerned, it's
sure.
The final version.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Janet.
I think we found something similar in Section 14, or at least deals with the same issue in Section 14.
Okay.
Page 11.
Exactly. Sneaky little Section 14. Bingo! Good eyes.
I see the language, and it's in 070. That must be existing. This wasn't the, Mr. Chair, this wasn't the goal of what we were trying to accomplish. So this is either existing law.
It looks like it
wasn't
rewording
of existing law, but I'll need to double check.
Not all bolded in Section 14 as it was in the original Section 2.
Yeah, so I'll need to take a look at it and let you know. We're not related to the policy issues around a suit or not. We're not trying to wade in either add requirements or delete requirements. It's more about administrative licensing and those kind of things. So I need to do a little bit of homework. If it's existing law, we want to leave it alone. If this is something new, we're not trying to add it.
Perfect. Thank
okay.
you very much. Appreciate it.
Taylor?
Hi, Chair.
Thank you. Give him our personal thanks for doing all the work.
Thank you, Chuck, for doing all this work and Bill.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, we're just getting good pictures of you. I can't get them
out. I think it's just rewinding.
Brooklyn.
Good morning, members. I'm Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council. Yes, what we were doing in 14, amending 447-070, it's basically the same thing that we were doing in Section 2 on the original bill. All we are really doing with the amendment is reflecting a couple of terminology changes. Throughout the Dash 1 amendments, we have referred to a person operating a plumbing business. We have changed those references to say a plumbing contractor. And we also currently register those people, and this reflects that they are now going to be licensed. And that's really all we are doing in terms of the amendment.
Representatives?
I'm going to look at the bill a little bit further. And just, instead of vetting it out in front of the committee, I'll read a little bit closer.
Thank you, Chuck. Any other questions that Chuck might answer? Okay, thank you, sir. Jared?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot, representing the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. And just wanted to put on the record that to thank Representative Holvey for the hard work and the hard work of this committee to allow us to work through the amendments on this bill. Obviously, Janet has worked extremely hard as well to make sure that we can get this right. And as Mark indicated, there's a couple words that need changed, and we would like to see the referral to Ways and Means rescinded. So between now and that point, we'll work to get the amendments that we need to the bill, and I'll commit to work with Representative Kitts to make sure that his concerns are taken care of as well, and we'd like to see the bill amended and moved out of the committee to the floor and its final form as well. So for the folks that we represent that are licensed under these statutes, we commend everyone who's been involved for the hard work, and we think that we're 99.9% there, and we can get those changes and move the bill forward.
Thank you, Jared. Okay, and with that, then, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2181. And Representative Smith is here.
You are horrible.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2790, and Representative Smith.
Dun, 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 dun. Well, good morning, Chair Brown and committee.
Good morning.
I'm Representative Patty Smith. I represent East Clackamas, East Multnomah, and Hood River County. Very proudly of my dad. I'm here today to speak in favor and support of House Bill 2790, and I don't know what the committee has heard about this bill, if this is the first
one. We're just getting started. You're the first one.
I'm the very first one, so I'm really not here to explain the bill other than I'm very supportive of it. And I'm sure there's others that will be following me that can tell you exactly what this bill does. But I know it's a cost-effective way to return patients to work more quickly than the drug surgery model. And I just kind of wanted to tell you a little bit, and my neck is hurting as I'm doing it, so I'm glad there's chiropractors in the room.
Come forward, please.
Yeah. As one who...
Mr. Chair, I have that pain, too, and it sits right next to me.
I'm sure. I think that's what caused mine. It sits next
that's
to
enough.
Me on the floor.
Forgive me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. It is Friday.
Right.
It hurts the best of
They're this way all the time.
Oh, are they? Well, Mr. Chair, you do a great job, then.
You're herding cats.
No comment.
No trouble on this end.
No trouble on that. I'm glad you said that, Representative.
I didn't say cougar.
I just want to tell you a little bit about my experience with chiropractic care. As one who didn't really believe in that as another medicine, and I kind of came to be a believer after an automobile accident about 1991. And I went to doctor after doctor and had medical problems with my neck. And I finally went to a chiropractor, and I didn't believe in them before then. And they actually, you know, even though my neck hurts now, it wasn't nearly as severe. So I became a real believer in the kind of alternative medicine that they can provide, the support they can provide, and they're very good physicians. So I'm here to offer my support for them being the attending physician classification on these worker comp claims. They greatly improve the regulation of chiropractic care in Oregon, this bill does. The chiropractic care is chosen because they want to avoid drugs, and I think that's why I chose them. And that's really all I wanted to let you know, was I was very supportive of this bill, and I'm very supportive of our chiropractors in this state. And with that, thank you.
Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And how long does it take to get to Medford, Representative Gilman?
4 hours.
Thank you very much. I'm on my way to another hearing. Thank you very much.
Everybody else says we're going to keep Representative Kitts here.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. I can't read all these things. The only one I can see for sure and read on there is Michael Mason.
They're doctors.
Well, I get them all here.
Well, I guess so.
I'm sure it is. My girl.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair Brown. Members of the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, it's a pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Michael Mason, along with Bob Olson, who has the distinct height advantage. I represent the Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic. And we're here today, of course, to support House Bill 2790. We very much appreciate the opportunity to address you. The Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic strongly supports this bill. Wanted to also mention that Dr. Vern Sabo, who is at a symposium in Texas, sends his regrets that he's not here. I know he's contacted a lot of folks about this, but the Chiropractic Association of Oregon also supports the bill. The chiropractic community is united in supporting it. It is a simple bill. It simply ups the 12-visit maximum over 30 days in the workers' comp law for that length of time for attending physician status for chiropractors up to a maximum of 24 visits over 90 days that's needed for treatment of serious injuries. We'll have more discussion about those injuries from the chiropractic doctors who are here today. But the legislature should increase this attending physician time of chiropractors now because chiropractic care is cost-effective. Because there's been greatly improved regulation of chiropractic in the 15 years since the Mahoney-Hall bill slammed the profession, and because it's an issue of patients' rights. The chiropractors aren't chasing ambulances. The workers come to them for care. And a lot of that is because they're trying to find a way to avoid surgery, and the chiropractic model avoids that in most cases. And savings in treatment costs, and we'll have some more testimony about studies. The largest study was in Texas, 900,000 workers' compensation claims studied. Chiropractic care for low back claims ended up costing half of that of medical doctor care when the chiropractor provided only 50% of care. So that's, I think, very significant. And I want to introduce the president and vice president of Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic. We have the president, John Schmidt, whose practice is in Silverton, and both longtime members of the organization, and Dr. Roger Satira, whose practice is in Portland. Dr. Satira, I should mention, is a part owner of the Physicians Hospital, the old Woodland Park Hospital, and has physicians privileges in that hospital. And I know there are questions, but I'm going to turn it over to the doctors. Thanks again.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Satira, Roger Satira. I've practiced in, well, I'm a native Oregonian, born and raised in the Oregon City area. I've been practicing at my same location at 111th and Stark Street for since 1974. I want to really thank you, members, for allowing us to be here today and taking time from your schedule to hear what we have to say. Our association is grateful for your consideration of House Bill 2790. And currently, doctors and chiropractic enjoy restrictive treatment, as you know, in 30 days. And most of our patients, we have found, respond. We have the research project to show that. Respond in about 95% respond in 90 days. So we have numerous studies to support that. And I have brought one of the brief ones with here today. So we have a lot of documentation that you wanted. And we also have a couple of summary outlines. That's only 3 pages long as compared to 500 pages long. And we feel that chiropractic has proved itself to be more cost-effective and will lower all of our workers' comp costs of the injured worker. But more importantly, it will give the individual patient a place to go to be treated and we can not receive drugs for a potential surgery. And we feel it's better for the health and well-being of the citizens of our state.
Next.
I have a little bit more than Dr. Sotarum, so if I start getting pushed on the time, give me a signal. I want to explain a couple things. First, I have a statement. Yeah. It's the record.
There you go.
I should know that. I'm John Schmidt. I'm president of Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic, and I practice in Silverton, Oregon since 1971. I've been around this profession all my life. My father was a chiropractor and in fact attended these legislative hearings, believe it or not, when I was about 10 years old and went to the meetings, so I got a long history. So if you want any historical data, Dr. Sotera and I can probably answer that. I served on the state association in a position of leadership at the time that this legislation was passed that restricted our practice, and so I have a pretty strong background in that. If anyone sitting here or anyone in the works session that we hope will happen has any questions, I would be glad to come and answer them. I served on the Board of Trustees at Western States Chiropractic College for 14 years and have been president. This is the second time I've been president of the State Association. That being said, I would like to explain a couple of things. 5 years ago, I would not have thought that we would even be able to be here today because there was not the amount of information, i.e. research, available to support putting chiropractic back into the system to the level at which we're requesting. However, in the last 3 years, things have been coming across my desk one after another, research studies from all over the world. I included 5 of what I thought were the best and most recent studies, and if you could take a look at this piece of paper that I entitled Saving Money for Oregon's Economy, you'll notice that there are studies, one published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, one from North Carolina, one from from England, the British Medical Journal, a Texas study, and a Florida study. All of these studies essentially say the same thing, which is that chiropractic care is significantly, significantly more cost-effective in rendering care to all but the most severe spinal injuries. So our goal is to help you understand that without requesting you to read that book. As Dr. Sotera says, we read it, we really don't want you to read it. But so what I did was prepared this summary page, which takes what I thought were the best sentences out of context. And then in that book, if anybody with any of your aides want to look at it, the book is organized by sections so that they could look at section 2, for example. There's a summary of the North Carolina study, but I included the entire study in case someone questioned the statement here or the statements in the summary. I would like to, that being said, I would like to read a little bit of prepared testimony, and then I would answer questions. I would like to emphasize what Dr. Sotera said, and that this is more than anything, a bill that will partially restore patients' rights to choose an alternative to the drug surgery approach to health care for back injuries.
Chiropractic care restores motion to the spine and improves function of the spine, and we use a wide variety of methods. There's a saying, if you go to 10 chiropractors, you'll find different types, 10 different types of chiropractic care. That's because we all find different methods and techniques that accomplish the same thing, but what we're trying to accomplish is improve function. So there's basically four different types of muscular ligamentous injuries. You have your simple strain, which 12 visits in 90 days allows us to take care of very adequately. A strain is uniquely different than a true sprain. There's three types of sprains, mild, moderate, and severe. So if people have anything other than a strain, and they have either a mild, moderate, or severe sprain, the present law does not allow us to care for those people beyond the time limit that a strain would occur. A strain is basically where you overwork, you're holding your muscles in a certain position for a period of time where they become inflamed. There's no actual tearing of tissues. So when I was active in the state association back in 1990, actually 1988-89, when all of this emphasis to get the bill passed that we're here to try to change, there was some research available then. And in fact, there was a study done in Oregon by a good friend of mine, Dr. Chakoki, along with Dr. Roland Martin, who was the medical doctor and director of the workers' comp, that even then showed that chiropractic was more cost-effective than the care rendered by our medical counterparts. But there was a huge amount of political motion in effect at that time, and when that special session occurred, basically there were some last-minute negotiations, and they came out of the room and they said, well, here's what you're getting, 12 visits in 30 days. And I was on the executive board, and I said, why 12 and 30? And somebody said, well, it sounded good. So that's where 12 and 30 came from. These numbers are based on absolutely no logic and no science. The limits and controls were chosen purely for political purposes to get things done and end a special session. The present law allows the chiropractic doctor to treat only, as I mentioned, these conditions called simple strains. The present limitation in visits and time does not allow us to give cost-effective care to the more involved cases, which are in your sheet number 2, 3, and 4. As a result, it is my opinion, after reading all of this stuff, and like I said, 4 years ago, I wouldn't even have thought of coming here with this bill. But after I read all this, I thought it would be pretty easy to make the case that if we would change this, we could save the state of Oregon a significant amount of money. Yes, there is less money being spent on chiropractic care and workers' comp, but the employers are going to turn around and end up paying it out of their health insurance, because these people are going to get injured, and they do get injured, and they come in to see me, and I say, are you sure this wasn't on the job? And they go, no, but you can tell that it's a yes, if you understand what I'm saying. So the costs are still there. The costs are deferred to the health insurance. The health insurance goes up to employers, and the employees are paying the health insurance premiums, and the health insurance premiums go up. So I fail to see where the savings are there. Basically, I also think, in addition to the loss of money as to the actual cost, there's a huge loss in human resources due to the denial of chiropractic care to the patient. These people get injured, they can't get appropriate care, they get involved with a medical drug type of care. There's a significant amount of addiction to narcotic drugs as a result of injuries not treated more conservatively when that could occur. There's a significant amount of scar tissue and surgeries that are done when that could not occur. And I think that chiropractic interventions restore neurological and muscular soft tissue functions. The studies in this paper absolutely prove that. The people who are now our gatekeepers, if you want to call them that, are basically, according to the American Medical Association Resolution 310 in 2003, 82% of the medical school graduates that are now designated by the present law to authorize chiropractic care beyond the 30 days, quote, and this is from the AMA resolution, 82% failed to pass the basic competency test in musculoskeletal medicine. Every chiropractor is well trained in the treatment of musculoskeletal injuries, way beyond our medical counterparts. And we're not casting stones. We're just saying people should have a choice. They go to them, they can go to us, but for us to be under them, and this still would leave us under that gatekeeper, but only after 90 days. I would like to encourage you to change what I consider to be a prior mistake.
that was based purely on last-minute political negotiations, which occurred in the absence of science, and try to get this bill moving so we can give good character. Thank you.
Can you tell me at the time when these limitations were placed on the chiropractors, what was the thinking? Why was there a, what was the reason then?
How much time will you give me?
3 minutes?
Okay, I'll see if I can summarize it. In about 1988, I was in a seminar in Portland, Oregon, and a representative from Safe Corporation came and said, you guys need to get your profession under control because we've got data here that shows that you're 2.5 times more expensive than medical doctors. I took the papers that they supplied. I went home, and I started working. In fact, Dr. Sabo, who most of you know, who is pretty active in our profession, trying to educate people, he and I got together, and we took several other chiropractors who were well-educated leaders in the profession, and we went away for a weekend retreat, researched all of the data that we had, and came up with what we called a white paper on chiropractic that refuted SAFE statistics. Unfortunately, for political reasons within our profession, that white paper never was published or distributed to the legislature, but quite frankly, I don't think it would have made any difference because there was such a... There was so much political motion with this thing because of the publication of the 2.5 times more expensive that we couldn't stop it. It was like a steamroller. And essentially, I think what happened was the 2.5 times, intentionally or unintentionally, was an interpretation of the fact that the global cost, and I wrote this down, the global cost for chiropractic were all included in the cost comparison. In other words, when a patient comes to me, I do an exam, I do an x-ray if required, I apply my own physical therapy, I do my own care, I write my own reports, and I'm the whole cost. What they did was they compared my total cost with my GP friend down the street who saw the person prescribed the medication, told them to come back in 2 weeks. They weren't better, so we referred them to physical therapy. The physical therapy costs weren't included. The MRI costs weren't included. The x-ray wasn't included. The physical therapy wasn't included. And the pharmaceutical costs weren't included. So they compared the MD who was doing the referral out to the chiropractor who was doing the cold care. So what they did is they did not compare apples to apples.
Basically, what they did is we have what Dr. Smith's trying to say is that in fact, I was very active at the time, and I was instrumental in developing the database to develop the cost averages, so we could average everyone's cost, and all the chiropractic costs were bundled. In other words, everything was included in their cost, and the medical provider did had unbundled costs. All they included was the office visits to the medical doctor. What came down to it, it doesn't matter how it was cut. Faster, we were still faster, better, cheaper. And there was 40 some doctors in our profession who were abusing the system. And I published their names, I published their averages, I asked them to stop. I asked our board to do something to these people, but unfortunately it didn't get prevented in time. So yes, there were 47 that were causing some problems, but there were 1,100 doctors who were not. And there was a lot of political things going on that was very unusual. For example, we had a publication by one of the major companies involved in this who said they were losing $1 million a week and they couldn't find $100 million. But 6 weeks later, they found the $100 million. So that was in the Oregonian. I'm just quoting what was in the Oregonian. So there was a lot of misinformation presented.
I might add that's covered in a lot of that's covered in that book under I think section 8. There's a evaluation of the SAFE study, but it does not address this thing about bundling and unbundling and the cost, because that would require another 30-page paper. We don't know if that, we will never know if that was intentional or unintentional, but it was obviously not accurate.
Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
You want to address anything? Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee.
Could I have John Schultz? and Lisa Trussell. Morning, John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here today to testify in regard to House Bill 2790. You've heard quite a bit about the bill so far, so I'll try not to repeat what you've already heard. This bill does allow chiropractic physicians to treat injured workers for 90 days or 24 visits, which is an expansion, as you heard, of their current authority under current law, which limits treatment typically to 30 days or 12 visits. I do think it's important to bring up that there are two other possibilities for treatment by a chiropractic physician under current law, and they shouldn't be overlooked. Chiropractic physicians can provide treatment beyond 30 days or 12 visits if, in the first instance, an attending physician authorizes additional visits, or secondly, if a managed care organization authorizes the chiropractic physician to act as an attending physician. And in that case, they, through the MCO process, they can treat without restrictions. This issue is an important issue for the workers' compensation system. We've had great success here in Oregon in lowering the costs of our workers' compensation system over the past 15 years. We estimate that there's been $10 billion in savings for Oregon employers in terms of premium savings since the reforms. They were mentioned earlier, the Mahoney Hall reforms. But those, I don't think that we should stop there in terms of just the savings to employers. I think it's also important to look at what else happened since those reforms. And I won't go through everything, but we've done something here in Oregon that I don't think any other state can claim, and I think it's something very remarkable. We've been able to save money for our employers while increasing benefits to our workers, and that's quite an accomplishment. We've increased our wage replacement benefits to workers. We've increased our permanent disability benefits to workers. The time that workers are taking to recover from a disabling injury, in other words, the time that workers are spending off work is greatly reduced. In other words, we get our workers back to work faster, and I think that's a win for everybody in that situation. And we have much less permanent disability in the state now. So through a combination of safety as well as treatment that's being provided to workers after the injury, we're seeing some very good outcomes for our workers, and I think that's real important, and I didn't want to miss the opportunity to point that out. On this bill, the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee reviewed this bill and is not recommending that the legislature adopt this policy change. One of the things that I think is very important to consider is we've talked about cost. Cost is just one outcome in terms of workers' compensation. The amount of time that the worker loses from work is important. Their ability to return to work at all is very important. Their wage recapture when they do return to work is important, especially if they're left with permanently disabling condition. The workers' post-treatment symptoms and pain typically is the one most typically talked about is an important factor. So there's a lot of outcomes that need to be considered when we're looking at medical treatment. The Management Labor Advisory Committee is considering a study of the cost, impact, and efficacy of chiropractic services that is proposed in House Bill 2588. It's the committee's position that evaluating the impact of expanding authority of a group of treatment providers, to do that evaluation is reasonable before recommending or making a policy change. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can for the committee.
Any questions?
Just one.
Representative Shawford.
The 2588, isn't that, that's the study that the chiropractors are asking for? Is that the same bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shawford, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, do physical therapists ever, are they required to operate under attending physician laws for workman comp purposes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, physical therapists, for them to treat an injured worker, someone who qualifies as an attending physician must refer the worker to the physical therapist. The physical therapist has to develop a treatment plan, which they submit to that attending physician. It must be approved, and then oversight must be provided by that attending physician, and re-referral for physical therapy, if necessary, must come from that attending physician as well.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long can one of these plans or for physical therapy, do they have to be reviewed by the attending physician every 30 days, or can they extend beyond that time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I apologize. I don't recall off the top of my head if there's a time limit placed on physical therapy specifically. What I can tell you is that they do need to be reviewed periodically. An attending physician is very unlikely to refer to a physical therapist for unlimited physical therapy. So I think the answer is that, yes, an attending physician is periodically going to be reviewing that physical therapy plan and the treatment that's being provided.
But there is no set amount of days to follow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I'd like to get back to you specifically on that if I could. I'm just not certain as I sit here today.
Thank you.
Any other questions, John? Lisa?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and I'm here today in opposition to House Bill 2790. As you've heard, we did something magnificent. The state of Oregon did something magnificent in 1990. It tackled a huge problem and successfully resolved it with positive outcomes for both employers and employees. The workers' comp reforms of 1990 lowered cost, increased benefits, and focused on workplace safety and accident prevention. And as Mr. Schultz just indicated, the state's seen some remarkable outcomes as a result of those. As part of the bill in 1990, which I happened to have the pleasure of being one of the 14 people that was sequestered at Mahonia Hall for about 5 months working on the bill that later became 1197, a lot of time and thought went into it, and I heard reference from the previous panel about a last-minute change. The last-minute change, when the bill came out and was originally printed, the chiropractic amendment was not in it at all. And as you can see, it's a sub-B in the law. And what happened, the compromise was to put them back into the bill for 30 days and 12 visits. One of the things that we have with this bill also is the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and that has successfully worked for 15 years serving the needs of employers and workers, analyzing and recommending to you as policymakers issues relative to the system. And I think that that's a significant signal when the workers and management folks are not recommending this policy change. As Mr. Schultz mentioned, you know, the consideration is ongoing on the chiropractic study. One of the things that is in the current system is you can continue to treat as long as you have physician oversight, or we created a vehicle called a managed care organization, and you can get alternative providers of any sort have access to the managed care organizations. Now, in the past, we'd heard anecdotally that, well, it's very difficult for an alternative care provider to get into the managed care organizations and be treat as attending physicians. Well, the department looked into that for the Management Labor Advisory Committee recently, and in the last 3 years, there has not been a single complaint from a provider saying they could not get access into the managed care organizations. And there has not been a single complaint from a worker saying they've been denied the type of care they wanted through the managed care organization. So I would encourage chiropractors and other care providers that are outside the definition to get involved with a managed care organization where they can treat as attending physicians. But I'd ask that you oppose this bill. One other comment I would like to make is that on the cost implications, I'm sure that around the halls here in the Capitol are several companies represented that were self-insured and continue to be self-insured, and it would be interesting to have their perspective on what their medical cost breakdown were in 1989 compared to what they are today, and take a look at how the provider categories have shifted as to who their top payer. I ran a self-insured program back in those days, and my single highest provider was Chiropractic Care, and they also had the largest number of time loss days authorized.
Thank you, Lisa. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 2790? And then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2790 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3006. Janet, give us a summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I can find the folder. Mr. Chair, House Bill 3006 prohibits certain state employees or the employee's relative from entering into a private contract with a contractor that has within the previous year, previous 3 years, bid on or entered into a public contract with the state contracting agency that employs the employer. So the bill also applies to state employees whose duties directly or indirectly include decision-making authority over the contracting activities of the agency. So it's not any employer of an agency. It's the people that are involved with the contracting portion of the agency or activity of the agency. If the employer or relative entered into a private contract with a contractor within 3 years before the contractor bid on a contract with the employer's agency, the employee must immediately disclose the previous private contract to the agency and may not participate in the formation or administration of the public contract. Representative Steve March is here, and he was the sponsor of the bill.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. This was brought to me by some representatives of a contractor who had some dealings with a state agency, and one of the employees at one point asked the contractor to do some work for them in essence make a bid. Well, of course, there appeared to be at that point this employee could have an influence on future contracts. The contractor did make a bid, and it was a very low ball bid, so because he wanted to make sure he stayed in good stead with this employee. So this bill is an attempt to clarify those relationships. There's also been problems, it's my understanding, in the past where someone's worked with a contractor in the past and gotten good deals, and so they kind of moved that contractor to the head of the list for projects. So In essence, we're trying to ensure that the contracting process is fair and ethical. I think as the bill was drafted, it's a little overly broad in terms of there's currently, I believe the family relationship is written a little too broadly for one. I also believe that, and we'll have testimony here from DAS and others perhaps, that we need to clarify the meaning of a private contract. And so I appreciate you hearing it. I think conceptually it's a good idea. I'll just say for the record that Oregon's conflict of interest laws are relatively toothless. We do not have a strong agency or a well-funded agency to look in. The Government Standards and Practices Commission is relatively small, and you and I file our reports with them annually, and people can follow up on those. But when I worked in the state of California, and I wasn't an elected official, I was fairly far down on the list of running a very small $415,000 agency. I've filed a conflict of economic interest statement. So, you know, that in that state, there was a lot of safeguards to make sure that there was follow-up, that there were no unusual relationships between an employee and the contractors. So my intent here is to tighten up on our contracting rules and on our reporting requirements perhaps a little bit and make this ensure that contractors and employees are operating in an ethical and fair manner. And with that, as an introduction, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions?
I've got a question.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative March, I'm just going to throw out a scenario to you and tell me if that would apply under this. If, for example, you had the head of a Department of Corrections for a county, not a state, but a county, so obviously a state agency or state-funded, and this person were related to an individual that was housing sex offenders for profit,
mm-hmm.
but this person was directly related to that person whom had jurisdiction and oversight over those particular sex offenders. So you essentially have a private, unaffiliated contract, but the contract is not with the agency, it's with the parolees or probationary probation folks that are in there. Would this bill apply in that situation?
And if those were state employees that did the contract, yes. If they're if it was a state money going through a county contract, no. That would be subject to other laws and rules. And but I'd be more than happy to work with you to try. If that is an existing problem, I'd be happy to see if we can tighten up on that.
What I meant to say was legally challenged individuals.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Reverend Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative March, is there any reason why you limited this to state employees when we also have contracting agencies that are schools, cities, counties? As such, wouldn't that same relationship exist in those public contracts as well, which ORS state statute governs?
It could, and I'd be happy to look at that. I was focusing on the issue that had been brought to me, which was involving state employees, and that's why I approached it that way. But I have heard of, for example, a county road director kind of, you know, having some asphalt laid in his driveway by a contractor who maybe should have charged him for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Can I have Dugan Patty, please? Jessica, why don't you come on up, too? Mike, did you have any testimony? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division, the Department of Administrative Services. The Department, as the bill is currently written, the Department can't support the bill. But I want to state that the Department is completely in agreement with Representative March around the concept that public procurement should have the highest ethics, should be fair dealing, it should be really an operation that we can be proud of, because integrity in the contracting process is critical to what we do. So we agree with him on that point. Our concern around this bill is really the broadness of the bill. As it's currently written, it has at least three areas of difficulties that we think need to be tuned up and adjusted. One of them has to do, and Representative March touched on it, has to do with the definition of private contract. It's very broad, and in the contracting community, we see any agreement that is in writing where there's consideration to be a contract. So as this is written, if it were to pass today, I would have to explain to my daughter that I really don't want her to get telephone service with a contractor that we have contracts with here in the state, or if we do, then I have to pull myself out of any decision-making around negotiating telecommunications contracts with the state. And I don't think that's the that's not the consequence that Representative March intended to deal with in this bill, but that's the way it's written. It's fairly broad. It also, I think, would be very difficult to administer from the standpoint of any contractor who has submitted a bid or proposal in the course of the last year. We have to avoid having any kind of dealings with those contractors. Well, a lot of the things we do in our day-to-day lives, as this bill is currently written, could have an impact. So it would be hard for me to know, for example, who bid on something over on all the bids we take over the last 3 years. But I do know that, for example, we did automobile tire bids. Well, that means that I have to be careful about where I buy my tires, because anybody who bid on those would cover me here, so I have to avoid.
Easy.
Yeah, so I have to avoid.
Can we move on?
So there are some practical consequences that have to be worked out. There's another practical consequence here that I think we have to be thoughtful about, and Representative March mentioned this as well, and that has to do with current ethics law covered under Chapter ORS 244. And generally governed by the Government Practices Standards and Practices Commission. This law would put a provision in ORS 279, which would not be administered by Government Standards and Practices Commission, would be administered by the contracting agency involved, or perhaps by DAS, once we kind of sort out who has the responsibility for this. But what the matchup is between the ethics provision that would go in 279, and is there any overlap with Government Standards and Practices, and what kinds of jurisdiction overlap there could possibly be, would have to be figured out. I think there has to be a clear demarcation. But I also want to say that I think this area of ethics and public contracting is extremely important, and I think that our overview of but my sense is that our overview of ethics as it relates to the universe of public conduct in ORS 244 is not so much focused on the public contracting process. So I can see where it makes sense to have some complementary ethics requirements in 279, and I don't disagree with the concept. Again, I think the idea of having clean government, accountable contracting practices, and integrity in state contracting practices really shouldn't be negotiable. That's paramount, it's critical, and we should have uncompromising policy when it comes to that. We're happy to work with the sponsor to get this bill to where it needs to go.
Thank you, Dugan. Any questions? Jessica.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Harris-Adamson with Associated General Contractors. We, too, have significant concerns about the bill as written. Even looking at the state portion, for example, our highway contractors who do work in both the private and the public sector. I think about a company like Morse Brothers, who has both a residential small division as well as a commercial division. They do a lot of work with Department of Transportation. transportation. They get a phone call, hey, can you do some crack seal work in my driveway? Sure, no problem, we'll be out this afternoon. Turns out that was a state employee. They charged him for it. It's perfectly responsible, legal, above board as it should be, but all of a sudden we end up with a conflict with this law. We completely agree with what Dugan just said, that the contracting processes in this state need to be above board. We shouldn't have folks laying asphalt in somebody's driveway, so wink, wink, nudge, nudge, I get the contract next time around. We do not support that kind of behavior, and I would submit to you that there are just a handful of folks that would fall under that scenario. The problem, I think, compounds itself as we get further in outlying areas, and you talked a little bit, Representative Holvey, about, well, what about smaller jurisdictions as well? When we start getting out, and again, back into the asphalt paving arena, as we get further out into eastern Oregon and some really small communities, your only option is the open pit, and you may only have one pit available, one contracting source with a batch plant available to both get county or city or even some state projects built from, as well as the small residential kinds of things that need to occur as well on concrete and asphalt. So for those folks in particular, this provides a particular problem in trying to, again, do the right thing by all of its customers and behave in an ethical manner, but also be able to bid public work and take care of private customers. It the same scenario would be in play for electrical contractors that go out and do small service jobs for the state and small service jobs for individuals across the state, including state employees. So I think what the representative is trying to do, we certainly support, we agree that there needs to be perhaps more work around contracting ethics. I know that was something when we did the rewrite of 279 last session, Dugan and I spent a lot of time discussing and trying to figure out how do we get from here to there, and we just flat ran out of time to really address that issue in depth, but I think, you know, we're willing to work on this bill or work in the interim to try and put some more language and substance around what do we do with contracting and public contracting so we do hit the ethics standard, because this is where we see the kinds of headlines of, hey, somebody got a special deal, or they got kickbacks, or, you know, somebody's asphalt was laid and it shouldn't have been for free. And we don't want to see that happen. We know the state doesn't want to see that happen, and we don't need any more articles in the paper on that kind of thing than absolutely necessary. So we want to solve the problem and are happy to work together to make that happen.
Thank you, Jessica. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you for your testimony today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3006, and then I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2790 to allow Representative Richardson to testify.
Kind of build a man on what happened.
Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I had not intended on coming down until I just decided, because of the experience that I've had, and by the way, I'm Dennis Richardson, and I'm appearing as an attorney with 25 years of experience, many of which dealing with people who have been injured and processes and costs and time involved with their recovery. And I also, if you know me, I have two real concerns in what goes on in the building. One is the efficiencies meaning the cost, the way we spend our money, whether it's our own agencies or quasi-agencies. And the second is turf. I have a real resistance to turf battles, and I think that the purpose of this bill, and by the way, I haven't heard anybody else testify on this, so I don't know what anyone else has said, but I was around in the 80s, in the late 80s and early 90s, when chiropractic treatment for workers' comp patients, clients were what was reduced. And as I watched it, it was clear to me that it was a turf battle between the docs, the medical docs and the chiropractic docs, and the med docs won. And it, and with that victory, there were a lot of people that who would benefit from chiropractic treatment they were the losers, and that with chiropractic treatment, it takes more than a couple of visits, because basically my understanding is that you're really trying to help the body get in a position where the body can heal. And I've read studies, and I've had hundreds of patients or clients who have been benefited, especially in low back injuries, through chiropractic treatment, and they weren't benefited as well through medication and just time. I also know, because of the way we track medical records and the costs in my law practice, that the cost for chiropractic treatment is generally lower than medical treatment costs when you add in all of the other things, because quite often, you know, medical doctors become gatekeepers and they say, okay, you know, go out and get this MRI, get this CAT scan, take these prescriptions, and then if this doesn't work, we'll change the prescriptions, and they do tremendous good. But when it comes down to certain back injuries, it's really about enabling the back to heal, not merely covering up the symptoms with medications and hoping that things will get better. And my goal is in coming here is to say that I believe that there is a place for chiropractic treatment in the various arsenal of weapons that we have in helping injured workers get better, and that we should restore enough time for that to take place, because it will save money when it's advisable in, you know, for a given injured worker. And so I would be in favor of this bill, because it's very simple, it's very clear, and it goes with common sense that if it takes more than 30 days for a chiropractor to work, then to limit it to 30 days is to, you know, bring about it's a waste of time and money. And so we ought to give more time, and then we also should not tie that in with medical doctors who have the ability to give more time, because for many of them, they're not going to make that kind of a referral for additional time to go to chiropractic. So I'm just saying that I favor it. I think it's clean, it's clear, and it'll save some money for workers and help them heal better in certain injuries.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative. Any questions? And the comment that Representative Kitts had about in this committee and turf battles, that's all we see every day.
It doesn't matter what the topic
is. It has nothing to do with chiropractors.
Not an easy job you have.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2790, wasn't that? Mm-hmm. And Janet, do we have any more for the good of the order?
No, Mr. Chair.
Katie, have.
Well, there's a letter to enter into the record on a previous bill, the House Bill 3272. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Janet.
It was in your package.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we have next week's schedule, 8:30 Monday, 4 o'clock Tuesday, 8:30 Wednesday, no meeting Friday.
Cool.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Janet. And without, we're adjourned.
Mr. Chairman, as usual.